people's lives are going to be disrupted on a daily basis. And as that happens, the alternate reality he's created is inevitably going to implode.
The president sought to defeat the narrative of COVID-19 with his usual tactic of, quote, censorship through noise. But the virus is proving resistant. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Italy has become the number one infection hotspot, pointing the way to the future of containment and maybe politics, too.
Yes, if the far-right message is Italians first, and then Italians have become pariahs because of the virus spreading there, it kind of upends their rhetoric.
And revisiting the once-and-future paradigm of films about pandemics.
I felt that I was watching no longer like a very entertaining worst-case scenario, but a thing that is happening all over the world right now.
It's all coming up after this.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Moments before tip-off on Wednesday evening's game between the Utah Jazz and Oklahoma City Thunder, the NBA scrambled to act on news that Jazz star Rudy Gobert had contracted COVID-19.
Utah's no longer on the floor. The Thunder are no longer on its bench. The officials have gone back to the locker room. The fans here in the arena don't know what's going on. We don't know what's going on.
You are all safe. And take your time in leaving the arena tonight and do so in an orderly fashion. Thank you for coming out tonight.
For now, no more TV studio audiences in New York and L.A., no more Broadway. Sports officials suspended all upcoming professional hockey, baseball, and basketball events. No March Madness, and Disneyland closed. On Thursday, the president said this.
It's going to go away. It's going to go away. I was watching Scott this morning. And he was saying within 2 months.
And this.
I mean, think of it. The United States, because of what I did and what the administration did with China, we have 32 deaths at this point. 32 is a lot. But when you look at the kind of numbers that you're seeing coming out of other countries, it's pretty amazing when you think of it.
And especially this.
Over the next few days, they're going to have 4 million tests out. And frankly, the testing has been going very smooth. If you go to the right agency, if you go to the right area, you get the test.
If only. South Korea, which discovered its first COVID-19 patient around the same time as the U.S., is testing 10,000 people a day, roughly the same number of people tested in the U.S. total since mid-January. And if we don't know who has the virus, experts say, we can't contain its spread, putting more Americans at risk. On Wednesday, political reporter Dan Diamond told Terry Gross that the White House rejected offers from the WHO to share the science behind its tests, saying that America would develop its own tests.
The World Health Organization did have a working test. Someone somewhere made the decision that the U.S. was going to go its own way. And that started a chain reaction of not having a working test and then having these delays for weeks.
There are widespread reports of tests delayed and denied because of shortages of kits and personnel. Also accounts by unnamed sources close to the president that he resisted offers by domestic labs to produce the tests because he didn't like the, quote, optics of national emergency that steeply rising numbers would imply. But the stock market surged when he finally did declare a national emergency Friday. According to McKay Coppins, staff writer at The Atlantic, when the president delivered his national address on Wednesday, a prepared speech from a monitor in a tone that seemed appropriately grave, it was a new turn in his public information campaign.
We declared a public health emergency and issued the highest level of travel warning on other countries as the virus spread its horrible infection.
Yeah, I would say it was a 180-degree pivot, at least in tone, from the way he had been talking about coronavirus. In the past several weeks, every time he talked about it or tweeted about it, it was with a kind of calculated cavalierness. This is no big deal. It's no worse than the flu. And the criticism of his administration's handling of it was a hoax or an effort to destroy his presidency.
Right.
I think that speech on Wednesday night was the first time that we saw him talk about the global pandemic with the gravity that most public health officials wanted to see from him weeks ago.
Kind of Trumpian gravity. He was using that tone that he assumes when he's being, quote, you know, presidential,
right.
Somber and sleepy. It has a kind of rhythmic whine. Da-da, 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 da-da.
Yes.
Da, 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 da. It's like he's trying to hypnotize you. Maybe it was a pivot, but it wasn't materially. You know, Politico has observed he's still reluctant to make a declaration of national emergency because that wouldn't fit into his narrative that this is going to go away by itself and it's not different from the seasonal flu.
From the very beginning, he seemed to handle it in a way that we've seen him handle a lot of other political battles in his presidency, which is that he thought that if he could control the conservative media's treatment of the story, he would be able to keep the political damage to a minimum. Where he miscalculated there is that the public health crisis that we're seeing unfold right now is fundamentally different than a lot of the other episodes of his presidency, in that eventually reality will assert itself, right? It's clearly spreading in the United States. The only real course of action for a president is to have a competent public health response. And so far, his actions have left a lot to be desired.
You talk about what you call Trump's alternate reality, where he fills the air with information that is false or mostly false or inconsistent. The point is not to even create a narrative, but to exhaust anybody who wants clarity and induce them to throw up their hands.
That's right. Scholars who study this stuff actually have a name for it. They call it censorship through noise.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal really isn't to necessarily make people have conviction in a certain set of facts. The goal is to make it so that people throw up their hands and just side with their political tribe. I watched the president's speech on Wednesday night on Fox News so that I could kind of see what the reaction would be right after the speech. And what was amazing to me was how quickly and seamlessly the entire messaging apparatus pivoted. Up until literally like hours before the president's speech, you had Sean Hannity on his radio show musing about how the coronavirus threat was possibly a deep state conspiracy to harm the president.
On immune systems, he said, quote, coronavirus fear mongering by the deep state will go down in history as one of the biggest frauds to manipulate economies, suppress dissent, and push mandated medicines. Maybe true.
And then you had the president give this speech where he acknowledged that it's a serious issue and it needs to be addressed. All of a sudden, you had Sean Hannity talking about this serious pandemic, and this president has taken decisive, aggressive action from the beginning.
Now, from day one, this president took aggressive and even unprecedented steps to prevent the spread and mitigate the impact of what is now a global pandemic. Make no mistakes, in serious situations, truth matters, facts matter, and unfortunately, there's been way too much politicizing of this, too much, well, untruths being told, and actually even some actually weaponizing what is a global pandemic. That all needs to stop. I hope it will.
I mean, frankly, I think Orwellian has become a cliched phrase in the Trump era, but honestly, this was as close to Orwellian as I had ever seen. And what it showed me was that what's going to happen in the days and weeks to come is that you're going to have this concerted effort by the same media apparatus that has been carrying Trump's narrative for the last few weeks. Now, make every effort possible to conceal that that ever happened.
But they can't do that because we still don't have test kits. It's still spreading, and you can blame it on Europeans or, as some of the Republican Party have done, blame it on the coastal states of California and New
right.
York, and he still won't have contained it.
The pivot that I'm looking for next in the conservative media is that you're going to start finding scapegoats. whether that's liberal politicians or governors on the coastal states, whether that's immigrants or China, so that the president doesn't incur political damage among his base.
And also damage to the narrative that America first is the only way to solve any problem.
And you saw it with his speech, right? The very first and most dramatic announcement he made was that he was implementing a month-long travel ban from Europe. As long as we can build walls and shut down borders, you know, then we can stay safe. I don't think that's the most important thing that's happening right now, but I do think that the entire project of the Trump presidency has been keeping a certain segment of the country inside this reality that he's created. And I think that that's under threat in a way that it never has been before.
There was another interesting case prior to this speech where Tucker Carlson, without naming names, suggested that perhaps the leaders ought to be taking this more seriously.
People you trust, people you probably voted for, have spent weeks minimizing what is clearly a very serious problem. It's just partisan politics, they say. Calm down. In the end, this is just like the flu, and people die from that every year. Coronavirus will pass, and when it does, we will feel foolish for worrying about it. That's their position. But they're wrong.
Yeah, Tucker Carlson was really interesting. He was actually, for a while, kind of the lonely dissenting voice in the Fox News primetime lineup, making the case that this should be treated as an emergency. It was really kind of an amazing moment where you saw this, you know, right-wing Fox News host pleading with the president to take this seriously. I don't know if that is, you know, the difference maker, but he clearly knows that the president watches. And there was at least one voice in this broader conservative media apparatus trying to get the president's attention.
What about the coverage on the other cable news channels, CNN, MSNBC? Do you have any observations about them, or were they both kind of true to form?
Well, I think, you know, for the most part, they were trying to inform the public about this growing public health crisis and warn about what was happening in other countries and how it could happen here. I do think, though, that, you know, if there's one critique you could make of the mainstream media, it's that for the last several years, we have been dialed up to 10, right? We've been covering every episode of the Trump presidency, every scandal, every moment with a sense of urgency. And I think that that makes sense given how, strange and extraordinary the last several years have been. But I do think that it comes at a cost, which is that when a global pandemic happens and we really need to get viewers' attention or our audience's attention and communicate that this is really urgent, I do think there's a certain number of people who are not inside the kind of Trump MAGA bubble, but still who have started to tune out media coverage because they say, well, they treat everything like it's a catastrophe. And, you know, usually things end up being fine.
I think that is true. It's exhausting watching the news. I also think it's infuriating because not only is everything dialed up to 10 or 11, but it's put through a political filter.
Right.
Either the filter of politics or on specialized channels, the filter of the market.
Part of what's happened is that the people who have remained plugged into the news after years of kind of exhausting political drama are the political junkies. And I do think that there is commercial incentive or an audience incentive happening here where everybody is playing to the people who watch cable news every day instead of necessarily trying to, inform the broader public.
A Quinnipiac poll released this week found that 68% of Democrats are concerned about the virus. About 35% of Republicans were. Does that sound like a public health crisis in the making?
Yeah, this is, I think, one of the most concerning results of the president's messaging, which is that they listen to the president, they listen to Fox News, they listen to Rush Limbaugh and Mark Levin and the talk radio world. And when they're all saying in unison, this is no big deal, this is no big deal, the media is creating a hysteria to hurt the president, don't let them win. When that's the message that's being beaten into them every single day, they naturally don't take the public health ramifications seriously. They don't think about, you know, canceling vacations or canceling travel or avoiding large gatherings or even washing their hands, right? And so this is one hopefully positive byproduct of the president now starting to change his tone, is that this will mean that the president's supporters will start to take him more seriously. But I think, you know, at this point, there's a good chance that the damage has already been done. Sorry.
Well,
the cough. That was a very on-message cough.
McKay Coppins is a staff writer at The Atlantic and author of The Wilderness, a book about the battle over the future of the Republican Party.
Coming up on The Meaning of Masks, East and West.
This is On the Media.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, neighbors quarantined in the ancient city of Siena leaned out of their windows across empty streets to join each other in song. So irresistibly old world. But in the context of the virus, says Rachel Donadio, who covers Europe for The Atlantic, Italy offers more than a charming YouTube clip. It offers the rest of the world a glimpse of its future.
Italy has emerged as a serious hotspot.
Italy quarantined the Lombardy region, essentially putting close to 17 million people on lockdown.
Despite the tough tactics, the virus is still spreading. Italy has nearly 12,500 cases, the second most after China.
As the death toll there surpasses 1,000, the government moved from a partial quarantine in the country's northern region to a complete shutdown on movement throughout the country. 60 million residents are to leave their homes only for the absolute essentials, and travel is permitted only by written exemption. Schools are shut down. Public activity is on a daylight curfew. As of Thursday, no other European country had taken such drastic measures. Writing in The Atlantic on Sunday, Donadio noted members of the public under quarantine are receiving life-or-death breaking news from a notoriously chaotic press. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Like other countries, Italy has sent out mixed messages once the novel coronavirus started appearing. You know, first it was, beware. And then it was, okay, not too aware. And then, no, really, beware. What effect did this lack of consistency have?
It's true that at first the government messaging was to be concerned. And then there was this movement when the virus started spreading in towns outside Milan, that Milan wouldn't shut down, that Milan doesn't stop, and let's all go and have an aperitivo as we normally do. And even a major political leader on February 27th, the head of the center-left Democratic Party, went to Milan and drank an aperitivo and said, Milan doesn't stop. And then last Saturday, he announced that he'd come down with the virus. And it was that evening that the whole country was put on this lockdown measures. So I think that it's been an emotional roller coaster.
One of the signals came from the media, who said, watch out, the government's fixing to lock you into northern Italy and not let anyone in or out. What happened then?
That's right. On Saturday evening around dinner time, Italian time, so around 8 o'clock or so, a draft bill was leaked to the press that indeed said Northern Italy is going on lockdown. And it was so unclear what the actual terms of this dramatic lockdown would be that thousands of people flocked to the train station and to the airport and headed south. So the whole point of these measures that were in fact put in place is that you need to practice social distancing. You need to keep away from other people. So cramming on virus-filled trains to the south was not exactly a great public health move. And it was because of that leak to the press that there were these hours of confusion. And in fact, Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte didn't make an official statement until a press conference at 2 in the morning. Things are fairly chaotic in the Italian media in the best of times.
You mentioned news organizations leaking that draft legislation about the lockdown in the north, which triggered the panic we discussed. Is it fair to say that the Italian news media have a less than sterling reputation for, let's say, equanimity, highly partisan, addicted to drama, cozy with politicians, sometimes a little thin on accuracy and context?
The Italian media has always had a complicated, cozy relationship with the Italian political establishment. And that was the case when there were more establishment parties, when there were the communists, the socialists, the Christian Democrats. They each had their own channel on Italian state television, and different business interests have different newspapers. Now, I think that what we're seeing in Italy is what we're seeing everywhere. It's just that Italy is doing it first, which is whatever problems or short circuit you have between politics and the media in any country is amplified and all the more dangerous when you have a public health crisis and when the release of information is actually something that affects human lives.
The push and pull in the media reflects a similar push and pull in the central politics of the country, which are pretty wild. It's very hard to coalesce and maintain a coalition to just even to have a government there. But I wonder if there's any signs that these fractious impulses have been chastened by this crisis. Or as the death toll mounts, will it be all scare headlines and political spin and accusations and politics all the time?
In Italy, information comes out and is leaked and it arrives from every possible direction and everybody has a different source and a different branch of the government. There's not centralized release of information the way there is in France, where President Macron will make a statement or the French health minister will make a statement. Before Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte in Italy gave a press conference announcing that these restrictive measures would extend to the entire country and not just the north, one of the leading politicians had already leaked that to a wire service. So it already came out before the prime minister spoke. But there's something kind of paradoxical about Italy. There's one of the former presidents of Italy, Cossiga, an interesting character, once said that Italians are incapable of keeping secrets. And so there's something about this anarchic release of information from all sides that winds up being weirdly more transparent than centralized release of information from governments. I mean, governments can lie as much as they want. You know, the numbers in a case like a public health crisis don't lie, but governments can lie about that. But if the information is just coming out in every possible direction, then, you know, you do have some material to go on.
One odd twist is the effect of the rhetoric worldwide on Italy's far-right parties and nativist elements. The xenophobes suddenly are cast in the role of the xenas that the rest of the world is phobic about. That can't sit well.
Yes, if the far-right message is Italians first, and then Italians have become pariahs because of the virus spreading there, it kind of upends their rhetoric. At the same time, these far-right parties happen to control the regions of the north that have been hardest hit by this virus, and they've been using this crisis as an opportunity to criticize how the government has been handling things. So there's still politics as usual tug of war between the northern regions and the central government. In the long term, if Europe doesn't come to help Italy, it will just embolden the far right. And they'll say, we're getting more help from the Chinese who donated respirators than we are from Brussels. If that becomes the line, then the far right populists, the anti-Europe populists, are going to be back with a huge vengeance.
What all of the West faces, unlike China or, say, North Korea, where COVID-19 seems to be wreaking havoc, is the need to balance public health and civil liberties, not to mention the need to stave off economic disaster, which is not a trivial concern. China finally swooped in and used its police power to apparently freeze the virus in situ, if the reports are true, and is seeing results, which is easy, relatively, for a police state, but for democracies, not so much. What do you suppose will be the balance in Europe and points west?
I think that it will just be this really tricky balancing act between what kind of information governments need to give so that people stay informed and healthy to prevent this pandemic from getting worse, and what kinds of information just actually provoke panic. I mean, there's also a certain sense of social responsibility, individual and collective human responsibility. And, you know, some cultures need the state to say, here's what you have to do. And other cultures, including many Western democracies, have a kind of community fabric where I think people will just recognize that this is the right thing to do. I mean, if you get the message from your government that if you are in contact with other people and an old person gets sick because you're carrying the virus, then, you know, shame might be as powerful as a government response.
Rachel, thank you very much. Oh, and go wash your hands.
Absolutely. I'll do that as soon as we're done. Thank you so much for having me.
Rachel Donadio covers politics and culture across Europe for The Atlantic.
As the coronavirus brings government readiness and the spread of not just infection, but also virulent fake news into focus, we take our lens to Ukraine, where as of Thursday, the country had 3 confirmed cases. In February, Novi Sanjari, a sleepy town of 8,300 people, about 210 miles east of the capital, Kiev, was torn apart by the virus before any cases were even found. In one night, 24 people were arrested for rioting, and 9 police officers were injured. Christopher Miller, who covers Eastern Europe for BuzzFeed News, described how a toxic mix of misinformation and fear ravaged the town. The story begins in mid-February when the government announced that 45 Ukrainians and 27 foreign nationals were being evacuated from Wuhan, China, and were en route back to Ukraine.
Ukrainians are wondering, you know, are these people sick? Have they been tested? Will they be quarantined? Are they just going to arrive here in the capital, Kiev, and then be allowed to go home? The government wasn't being very forthcoming with this information. And that, of course, allowed for rumors to spread on social media. As the plane got closer, the government didn't say whether it was going to land here in the capital, Kiev, and whether or not any of them had been sick with the virus before boarding this plane. So it was late February 18th. Social media started buzzing with rumors of these people possibly being infected. And it carried over into February 19th, when the plane and the government had finally come out and said, the plane is going to land in the city outside of the capital, and all of these people have been tested, none of them are ill, and we're going to take all of them to this tiny little town called Novi Sanjari, which nobody really here at that time had heard of, and they're going to be quarantined for 14 days.
Did the Ukrainians of Novi Sanjari have any reason to distrust the government?
There has historically been distrust in the authorities dating back decades, right? A very good example of that is the Chernobyl nuclear power plant disaster. Ever since then, there has been distrust in authorities. The local mayor told me, when you're not told everything that you need answers to, you're going to be fearful. And we feared for our lives, this feeling like death was knocking at the door of this tiny little town.
They were asking the government, why here? There are better hospitals, better facilities.
The prime minister himself told them, we didn't want a place that was largely populated and that was buzzing with people.
Oh, boy.
And of course, that only stirred more panic. in the absence of good information, a lot of people were filling this void, creating their own bad information, and not with necessarily a malicious intent. So there was one group that was created by the townspeople of Novi Sanjari to communicate with friends and neighbors. Facebook groups and private messenger chat rooms, they were communicating over Instagram and direct messaging each other. These were people communicating with people who they knew. But the media started picking up on what was being discussed in these groups. But there's not a whole lot of like verification that's done. Media tends to copy-paste news briefs from other sites and to post them to theirs.
I asked you if the citizens of Novi Sanjari had reason to distrust their government. How about their media?
A majority of Ukrainians consume their news via television, and all of these television stations are owned by various powerful business people who use these television stations to smear opponents. And then meanwhile, journalists had managed to find their way into these groups, interviewing locals, citing them as experts, and these ideas and rumors spread further and further until you had other cities also rising up and protesting in the way that this town of Novi Sanjari did.
Describe what it became. What did you see?
What everybody told me was that it was late at night on February 19th, and everybody's phone started buzzing. I sort of think of it as an Amber Alert that we might get in the U.S. when a child is abducted or there's a weather emergency.
Mm-hmm.
People described it like that. Their phones were ringing off the hook. Their messaging apps were beeping. The town mayor heard from one of her constituents first, and they pointed her to this Viber group. And there had been 5,000 or so messages that she hadn't read. And it was absolute chaos and panic. People had already begun organizing groups to come out to the streets. There was nothing at that point that she could do. They had already made up their mind that these people who were being brought to their town were sick, and that the only thing they could do was to protest and to keep them from coming here. You know, some of the messages were things like, if we go to bed tonight, we're not going to wake up tomorrow morning.
Mm-hmm.
They set up lookouts on the corners entering the city. They blocked the entrance of the medical facility where these people were meant to be brought. And when police showed up in large numbers, and not only police, but also the National Guardsmen wearing masks and carrying arms and marching in unison down the street with armored vehicles at their sides, they thought for sure that these people are sick. They're bringing sick people to town.
Did people die in this confrontation?
Nobody died, but 9 police officers were wounded, and at least 5 of them somewhat severely. There were 24 locals arrested. When I arrived to the town, I was shown by a lot of people who participated in the protests videos and photographs. The videos showed police shouting down protesters, protesters shouting at the police. Shouting at the people who were being brought in by bus to get out, to go back to China. Some women threw stones and shattered the windows of the buses carrying the evacuees. There was tear gas used by the police and pepper spray, and there were people in the crowd that were using a pepper spray themselves on the police. It was total chaos, and the town described it as a war zone. The president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, described the scene as something from medieval Europe. That, as you can imagine, wasn't taken very well by many of the townspeople there, who, even when I visited a couple weeks later to see President Zelensky greet the evacuees after their 14 days of quarantine, people were still very, very angry about that and really wanted some sort of apology from the president, which never came, by
mm-hmm.
the way.
I understand how frightened townspeople will rush to fill a void in information with their worst nightmares, but they didn't do this entirely by themselves. There seems to have been some deliberately seeded rumors about it. You suggest in subsequent reporting that it came from a foreign source.
Sort of right in the middle of all of this, with protests already underway, there's this mysterious email that goes out to hundreds, if not thousands, of contacts from the Ministry of Health here. This email included information that said five people had been infected with the coronavirus, and they were among the group of evacuees being brought back from China. And the email looks authentic. It has an email address that is assigned to the Ministry of Health. It has the logo of the Ministry of Health. The language is Ukrainian, and it sounds very professionally written. It was picked up and written about in the media, except that it was a fake email and found by the security services to have been sent by someone else or a group of people using what the security services here described as a foreign email service. Mm-hmm. For instance, a group of Russian hackers who have targeted Ukraine on several occasions in the past, or possibly political opponents of the current government trying to make things more difficult for them. And whoever sent this email out tried to make it look authentic in an attempt to stoke fear and panic and call on people to go out to the streets to protect themselves and protect their loved ones.
Tell me who the government used as proxies to help tell people about the coronavirus, the risks and the behavior it required to contain it.
Well, after the riots, the government did send the prime minister and its interior minister and its health minister out, and all three of these officials did meet and speak with townspeople and certainly did their best to explain that these evacuees who had arrived were not sick and they had been tested and they would be in quarantine just as a preventative measure. The health minister did actually quarantine herself to show to the townspeople and Ukrainians even beyond Novi Sanjari that there was nothing to fear of the evacuees quarantine there. She stayed with them and was released only when they were. But they also tapped celebrities to help them. And one in particular is someone I would describe as Ukraine's Dr. Phil, right down to the mustache. He has a large social media following, nearly 2 million subscribers on YouTube. And so he, in a video, announces that he's driving to Novi Sanjari a couple days after these riots to help calm the mood. And he meets with the townspeople. He strolls through town. He does some meetings in, I believe, one of the town's cultural centers. And his message is, look, you've been given some bad information. You've shared some bad information. Here is what you need to know. And after that, it does seem as though things in the town calm down a bit.
So aside from apologizing, what do you think the president and the health ministry should have done?
You know, the person who told me, I think, most concisely was Novi Sanjari's mayor. And she said simply, tell the truth. You know, the lessons for the government here really are keep your messaging clear, be transparent, engage with the media instead of flouting it. This presidential administration and government prefers to put out its own propaganda on social media. And there are lessons for the media as well. Better fact-checking, tracking down the original source. A lot of what we saw here was the media picking up messages in these social media groups that were coming from locals, not from doctors, not from medical health experts, not from the government, and turning them into news stories. And then also, of course, interviewing experts, not politicians. The talking heads on television were not medical health experts. Mm-hmm. They were politicians who have an axe to grind with the current government or were members of the current government. They weren't people who were telling the citizenry here how to keep themselves safe, which everybody in the town told me would have gone a long way in calming their nerves. And of course, you know, I'm observing from afar, but looking at my home country, all of the things that led to violence on the streets of this tiny little town in Ukraine exist also in the United States. The tools used to mobilize people, it was Facebook, it was Instagram, it was Viber, it was word of mouth. A lot of what we've seen in Ukraine, in the U.S., are politicians doing the talking. And what the public needs to know right now is fact-based information that can keep everybody healthy and safe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Christopher Miller covers Eastern Europe for BuzzFeed News.
For tens of thousands of years, humans have used masks as religious totems, war regalia and war trophies, folk celebrations, sports, sex play, shaming punishments, and of course, armed robbery. And here we are again. The image is so familiar. Asian travelers and pedestrians masked routinely to ward off contagious disease. In the Far East, the practice is commonplace, and amid coronapocalypse, also now here. Gideon Lasco is a physician and medical anthropologist at the University of Philippines, Diliman. He wrote recently in sapiens.org about the symbolism of face masks. Gideon, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
The image is now familiar in subways, on streets, in airports. Do they even do any good?
Face masks actually have very limited value for the general public. And it's only recommended for people who are healthcare practitioners or people who are actually sick.
What you've done in your piece is look at the many layers of history and culture that have informed public behavior in the midst of the coronavirus epidemic. And a lot of it has to do with social mores.
Yes. So in a country where people value conformity and compliance to rules, then wearing a mask can signify obedience to public authority. It can signify being a hygienic citizen.
Just the social compact of protecting others from you as well as protect you from others.
It's communicating to people that you're a responsible citizen. At the same time, we also see how masks at the personal level somehow tells you that you're doing something instead of just doing nothing in the face of this outbreak. One historian who wrote about the history of face masks in Japan used the notion of risk ritual to make sense of the appeal of masks among the Japanese. So just like the many rituals we do before an exam, a ritual before a big event, wearing a mask can be interpreted as a form of risk ritual to give us a sense of control in the face of this coronavirus.
But they significantly hide the identity of the mask wearer. And you believe that that is part of the mentality?
Yes. If we look at how masks have become popular in Japan, part of the appeal of masks in everyday life, not just during epidemics, but in regular days, for many people, it's a way of hiding themselves, avoiding being bothered by other people. So in that sense, the masks serve as a very physical barrier and also a social barrier. And what it does now in this time of coronavirus, it really marks people as either at risk or concerned about the illness.
Well, that's a paradox. It both marks them, but also offers them a level of anonymity or at least personal space that they otherwise might not get.
That's a very good point, Bob. In fact, some of the countries which are debating whether to recommend face masks, even if they know that it's not effective at all, but to recommend that only the sick wear it is to invite those people to be marked as such and therefore invite stigma, invite avoidance from other people. That's why this paradox is also messing up the attitudes, not just of individual people, but also of governments and how to deal with face masks.
There's another bit of collateral damage, and that is that the image of the Asian person wearing a mask has become so iconic that it has led to sometimes even violence because the wearer is perceived as an other and a threatening one as well. Is that a phenomenon only in the West?
It is a phenomenon everywhere, but the coronavirus is spreading all over the world. People are wearing masks all over the world, not just Asia. But at the same time, yes, it's not just a marker of a disease, but it is also, like you said, a marker of race. For example, I interviewed a man from China who traveled to Europe, and he told me that he doesn't need a mask, he doesn't want to wear a mask, but he felt that being an Asian guy, people might feel that he's at risk, so he better wear a mask just to prevent any kind of untoward interaction with other people. So mask wearing is not just for individual health reasons, but there's also a performativity involved in the wearing of masks that you have to display a compliance to unwritten rules of how you're supposed to behave.
The signaling actually isn't confined to individuals. Governments seem to use the same psychology of the placebo effect of mask wearing to at least create the illusion that they've got the situation under control. You wrote about some mayors in Philippines who distributed masks like some cities distribute smoke detectors.
It's definitely one of the main themes that I'm seeing in how masks are used now. Companies give it to their employees, governments. For example, the government of Singapore was highly admired because the government were distributing masks to every Singaporean. And that was a very powerful statement.
That's more than 1 million households, right?
Yes.
And how many cases of the disease had been confirmed at the time?
There were some cases. People were beginning to panic all over the region, and the responses of different leaders were being compared. And the Singaporean prime minister was the one who won the most acclaim, in part because of this decision. Like, look, wow, in other countries, people are running out of masks, but in Singapore, it's the government who actually distributing all of these masks. Even though in that same statement, they said that, well, you don't really need it, but they still distributed 5 masks per household or something like that. They saw the political efficacy of distributing these masks as a way of reassuring their population.
As you walk the streets of Manila, are you awash in masks?
It comes and goes. So when the news first broke that there's a first case in the Philippines, people were wearing masks. But then after a few days, nothing happened. So people stopped wearing them. But now there are more cases and more people are wearing masks again. I would say roughly 20% of the people are wearing masks. Taxi drivers, students, maybe around 1 in 4. I can see them wearing masks when walking on the streets.
Well, you're a doc and also a scholar on this very subject. Do you wear one?
I've never worn a mask for this purpose. I was just in Massachusetts last month to visit my sister, and I contemplated briefly, should I at least bring a mask with me? In the airports, maybe they'd expect me to wear a mask, but in the end, I didn't.
So this same behavior of signaling and expectation that you're observing in others, the same thoughts ran through your mind.
Absolutely. Even though I'm a scholar and a doctor, I am not immune to these thought processes that take place.
Gideon, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Dr. Gideon Lasco is a physician and medical anthropologist at the University of the Philippines, Diliman.
Coming up, the compelling consolation of an old movie, or one not so old nor so consoling.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 2 weeks ago on this program, we asked science writer Lori Garrett about an old advisory from our Breaking News Consumer's Handbook, Infectious Disease Edition, the one that read, Hollywood is pretend. Hollywood is pretend.
I was one of the 3 scientific advisors on the film Contagion.
Is there anyone else who might have had contact with her?
This was everyone.
Aaron Barnes did.
Barnes, he worked on another floor.
There were documents she needed to sign. He picked her up from the airport.
He picked her up from the airport?
Yes.
Where is he?
We went to great lengths to make it as accurate as we possibly could.
How are you feeling today?
Pretty cruddy, to be honest. My head is pounding. I probably picked up some sort of bug.
Where are you right now?
I'm on the bus heading to work.
I'd like you to get off immediately.
Wait, what? What's going on?
Many of the things that you see in the background in Contagion are things that I've either personally seen happen or that we role play. The empty shelves in the stores.
Is anyone even
working here?
The robberies of pharmacies. People at gunpoint trying to get food. The breakdown of trucking, shipping, delivery. The you're on your own, hunker down inside your home.
I heard that and I thought, well, if this person worked on that movie, I want to go back and watch it again and see how it feels to watch it now.
And so New York Times critic Wesley Morris downloaded the film for a rewatch that was, at least initially, kind of comforting.
It's just amazing how the letters for the organizations and the players in the crisis and nightmare that we're living now are in this neat little dramatic thriller that came out in 2011.
I know, it's crazy. I mean, down to the bats.
The virus contains both bat and pig sequences. In the bottom right, you can see the dark green is pig and the light green is bat.
One of the things I love about this movie is it's so much about competency, the belief that knowledge is the key to the solution to problems. Now, in the real world, we also know that is true, but we're at a moment where we don't know what to believe and we don't know what to do, in part because we are in the middle of incredible incompetency for no reason. This movie isn't really about the panic. It is about professional people getting their brains together to try to figure out a solution to a thing that is obviously panic-inducing.
You know, as I talk to you, it strikes me that maybe this is a kind of public health West Wing.
Mr. President, I need you to don a mask. This is a crash. Put these on, please.
Is this a drill?
No, sir. The environmental hazard monitor is detecting an unusual pattern of airborne particles.
An idealized view of how it's supposed to work.
You know, it's even smarter to think about it that way, because that way you don't have to deal with Aaron Sorkin having written it. There's no romantic speech. And yet it is this romance of efficiency and of government as the solution to national problems. And watching all these women being the faces and minds of the solution to this problem, too, is also really fascinating.
So you said that watching movie stars being world-savingly smart really does lower your blood pressure. But the title of your piece is, for me, rewatching Contagion was fun until it wasn't. When wasn't it fun?
Halfway through the movie, watching Elliot Gould lose it in that restaurant, watching the glasses being cleaned and the people coughing into their water.
Mm-hmm.
There was just something about the everydayness of a thing that a professional scientist might appreciate. And then I think I'd gotten a text from a friend of mine who was saying that another person had died. And I just thought about the way that art can crystallize your confusion and answer your questions without really being the solution to a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I felt in that moment that I was watching no longer like a very entertaining worst-case scenario, but a kind of crystallization of a thing that is happening all over the world right now, which is that people are living their lives and people are dying. And I know that that's a thing that happens every day, but under these circumstances when we really ought to be thinking more about how we should be living our everyday lives because people are dying, it got heavy for me.
I was glad. I mean, we could argue whether it could have been handled better, but I was glad that at least the issue of class
mm-hmm.
and nationality was addressed.
Mm-hmm.
When the village outside of Hong Kong was really set to be extinguished because they would be at the bottom of the list, that they decided to take a desperate
What's
measure.
What's going on? What are you doing?
You stay here with us until they find a cure.
How is that gonna help?
You're gonna get us to the front of the line.
It becomes clear that, like, they aren't your usual Asian bad guys, right? They do sort of toe a party line in terms of their skepticism about the seriousness of the virus. But then there's a plot twist, and the plot twist, to me, is entirely moral, and it's like winked at it, because the movie isn't about this class discrepancy, but it's not really about any one particular problem at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the number of ways in which a pandemic can bring out problems that already exist in societies.
Unscrupulous journalists, the fundamental problem of supply, the ever-present concern of both underreaction and military overreaction.
Yes.
It was a regular steaming bucket.
Yes.
And you set this movie against 28 Days, the zombie film, and the incredible novel Station 11. The AIDS documentary, How to Survive a Plague. I notice you don't mention the old Dustin Hoffman flick with the great chimp beginning.
Outbreak.
I'm just wondering, in the pantheon of bio-apocalyptic films that you've seen, you thought it had, what, the most gravity?
I think it's the one that most directly overlays onto the moment.
My wife makes me take off my clothes in the garage. Then she leaves out a bucket of warm water and some soap. And then she douses everything in hand sanitizer after I leave. I mean, she's overreacting, right?
Not really. And stop touching your face, Dave.
It's the most ideal movie of this sort to watch at this particular moment. This isn't pandemic porn. It is something much more considered in terms of the system having to work completely, all the agencies having to work with each other, maintaining, and I think this is really important, maintaining a tone among the agencies that keeps people from freaking completely out. You know, I think the best of this style of movie is something like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the one from 78.
What is this supposed to do?
Just a mild sedative to help you sleep.
I hate you.
We don't hate you. There's no need for hate now. Or love.
There are people that will fight you, David.
They'll stop you.
In an hour, you won't want them to.
I like myself a really good allegory, but we don't have the luxury at the moment if we want to get the sense of how bad this can go, of being too existential. Because I think we're still in the phase of procedure, right? We want a procedural explanation for what ought to happen. And so this movie is entirely procedural. There's not an existential question really in it. And I truly, honestly believe that there is something about watching people do their jobs well.
Mm-hmm.
People who don't get paid a lot of money to do those jobs, who are doing their work because they believe in it, and because it's the right thing to do, and because there are lives on the line. And if you mess up, people will die. And it's your responsibility to get your stuff together to help solve these problems. We are in a moment right now where that is not happening. Part of the reason people are going to keep dying is because the system isn't working the way it's supposed to. People whose job it is to keep us safe and to give us answers, they at the very least aren't giving us the answers. And the tools that are meant to keep us safe and tell us how much in danger we are don't seem to be working quite right. And you turn to a movie like this and you see not just so much how it could be, because this isn't even a moral movie. It's entirely ethical. But it becomes moral when you watch it feeling that there's a lack of competence happening on the other side of the screen.
I feel for those officials and, you know, laborers in our public health system who know better,
mm-hmm.
but aren't free
mm-hmm.
to follow their best professional instincts.
Mm-hmm. I will never forget the guest you had on a couple weeks ago, Liz Kim, works for Gothamist.
She was listening in on the phone pressers that were given by Nancy Messonnier of the CDC.
Nancy Messonnier sounded this alarm weeks ago. And when the Trump administration really gets skeptically involved and wants to sort of take over the communications aspect of all matters relating to this coronavirus, her tone had changed in the briefings.
Mm-hmm.
And she had seemed, I mean, I'm not being glib when I say this, body snatched.
Mm.
It really just kind of kills me because these are people who I don't know what it must be like to be on the ground trying to solve this problem, and your counterparts at the top are completely compromised for no good reason.
In your piece, you referred to an early scene when they're dissecting the brain damage of victim number one.
Oh, my God.
You want me to take a sample?
Or? I want you to move away from the table.
Should I call someone?
Call everyone.
I would, in part of this, I don't know if you have this while you watch this, Brooke, but I really wanted to know what is going on right now in these labs. I want to know how these people are going to work every day. My sister, for instance, is an operating room nurse, and the protocols at her hospital have changed. I don't think she feels like she's compromised and can't speak about, you know, whatever problems there are happening in her operating room, but I would love to know what it's like to be the CDC in a job not dissimilar from my sister's, right? Like a person who is responsible for serving in the context of a larger operation, but the operation is compromised for reasons that don't make medical or scientific or biological sense, but they're all political. Politics is an obstruction to solutions in this film. Not the government, politics. Well, I'll just say one other thing, which is that we should go back to 2011 for a second, because when the movie came out, it just was another thing to go see on a Friday night. And you can't go to the movies right now.
Right.
Like, movies that are supposed to open in a month are now moving to 2021. Mm-hmm. Movies that are supposed to open in a couple weeks are now moving to unknown release dates. I think that, you know, these communal public experiences, as we move further and further into ourselves, I think that a movie like Contagion is also useful. And I'm also curious to see if people pick up Station 11, because it's a very different piece of art. And reading it under these circumstances will just, like, I mean, get a box of tissues when you do it. But I wonder how we come out on the other side of this as people who, for a while, if we take this as seriously as I think we ought to, are going to be alone in our houses for a little while. Who do we want to be, and what do we want to be doing when we're allowed to leave again and gather in public places and just have fun? It has nothing to do with Contagion, but, you know, I'm sitting here alone in my house watching this movie that, you know, when it came out 9 years ago, I was watching in a theater full of extremely entertained people. Mm-hmm. Now that is a ill-advised social activity. And I wonder if it's going to make us hungry for that again.
Thank you so much, Wesley.
Oh, thank you, Brooke.
Wesley Morris is critic at large for the New York Times, as well as co-host with Jenna Wortham of the Times podcast, Still Processing.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, Asta Chattavetti, and Zandra Ellen. We had more help from Anthony Bansi. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. And by the way, we had more show than we could fit into the broadcast this week. So go to onthemedia.org to find those segments and sign up for our newsletter. And we'll tell you about the extras we send out each and every week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.